From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we recap a week in education news with reporter Rachel Morello.
Then, a Milwaukee native tries to reach a wide audience with a web series featuring the stories of transgendered males.
It's educational. It kind of sheds light on this experience that isn't really known in the public eye. But I would just love to be able to make a show that anyone would want to watch, you know, no matter what their experience.
Later, why onlyness is a better predictor than talent as a way to make a difference.
Often when people say someone's talented, they'll often say, oh, it's because someone has credentials or someone has the right academic background or the right brands that they've worked with. And I was trying to say, no, what is that thing that says each and every single one of us has some bit of value to add to the world?
And Bubbler Talk, plus Bubbler Talk, as reported by some students from Slinger. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Hard to believe it's already November 3rd. For students, teachers, and school administrators, we're about halfway through the fall semester. It's midterms for some, and simply time to take stock of the first couple of months of school for others.
WUWM education reporter Rachel Morello is always on top of what's happening in schools. She joins us every so often to help us catch up on the latest education news from the week, and that's what brings her into the Lake Effect studio today. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Mitch. It's been a few weeks since we've done this.
It has. Great to see you again.
You too. So, we know that a lot of people have attended parent-teacher conferences the last couple weeks, and hopefully you and everybody else has had a chance to sort of refresh and ready for another round of the quiz. So we'll start with what I call a review question, and if people listen to our last time around, which I did with Bonnie.
I was going to say, I was not here the last time around, so I might be in trouble.
She and I talked about this exact topic in our most recent segment, and that is that the University of Wisconsin System President, Ray Cross, introduced a plan last month to restructure the UW schools. And there's one step that still needs to happen in order to set that plan into motion, and that's set to happen next week. Do you know what that step is?
I don't have the slightest idea.
It was a vote to approve the plan by the UW Board of Regents.
You know, I should have gone with my first instinct. That was going to be my guess, but I was not sure.
That's all right. So the Board of Regents is the group that governs the UW system, and they're scheduled to vote at their monthly meeting this coming Thursday to approve this sort of merger that President Ray Cross has introduced. The plan's pretty comprehensive, and we've talked about it before, so listeners can find the details on our website. But just as a reminder, the sort of hallmark move is basically a merger or a bunch of mini-mergers. Cross wants to absorb the system's two-year colleges into the four-year schools. And the example I keep using is that UW-Milwaukee, as the big four-year school in our area, would absorb UW-Waukesha and UW-Washington County as sort of satellite campuses.
And these are specifically the UW two-year schools. These are not the technical schools.
Correct. The move is supposed to help boost enrollment at state schools, and Cross says even cut costs for students because they could start at a two-year school and transfer if they felt like it. It's been a pretty controversial idea among even some of the UW school chancellors. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. I'm 0 for 1.
That's okay. We got two more to catch up. So, Mitch, a new bill has been introduced in the Wisconsin State Assembly that's causing quite a stir. What is the name of that bill? I'll give you three options. Is it the Teacher Protection Act? Is it the Testing Limitation Act? Or is it the Student Lunch Rights Act? So teacher protection, testing limits, or student lunch?
I'm going to say testing limits.
Good guess, but it's actually the Teacher Protection Act. So it's a bill that just started making the rounds at the Capitol last week. It actually came out of the office of State Representative Jeremy Fiesfeldt, who's a Republican from Fond du Lac, and he chairs the Assembly Education Committee. And in essence, the bill does what its name indicates. It protects teachers from violent attacks by students. There have been some national statistics lately that show assaults and threats by students against teachers have actually been on the rise for the last decade. And Fiesfeldt says that Wisconsin's among the worst in the nation in terms of those sorts of attacks. So his bill would, among other things, require the police to share information with schools when students commit or are arrested for violent acts off of school grounds. And then schools, in turn, would have to share that information with the teachers who work directly with those students. It also includes some provisions that give teachers more power to initiate suspension against students, because normally that's something that happens on an administrative level. But critics say the bill would violate student privacy, and some argue it would disproportionately affect students of color and students with disabilities. And critics say it would be more beneficial to look at preventative measures like restorative justice programs rather than punitive action like this bill proposes.
All right. So I am 0 for 2 here, but I'm learning.
Yeah, you are. That's a good thing. All right, last question, Mitch. We'll see if you can get this one. Schools across Wisconsin are waiting on the latest round of state report cards. Those usually come out in the fall. What's different about this year's set of report cards? Is it A, individual schools will receive report cards, but districts will not? B, test scores no longer factor into school scores? Or C, voucher schools will receive scores for the first time?
I'm going to go C.
That's correct. Good job, Mitch.
I don't need a retake now.
No, yeah. So Wisconsin's public schools and the districts that house them have received scores on report cards from the State Department of Public Instruction for years. They're a major tool in the accountability system here because they give sort of a snapshot of how schools and students are performing on tests, what their attendance records look like, things like that. And actually, schools in all three of the state's voucher programs, so Milwaukee, Racine, and the statewide program, have been easing their way into getting scores. Last year, they've provided the first set of data in terms of attendance and test scores. But this is the first time they'll get actual scores. The state gives every individual school a score based on a scale from 1 to 100, and there are corresponding ratings from needs improvement to exceeds expectations, significantly exceeds expectations. Voucher schools needed 2 years of data. The DPI needs at least 2 years of data in order to make a comparison and calculate growth. So it almost goes without saying that there's a lot of tension and competition between public and private schools in Wisconsin for funding and other resources. So many folks in the education community are eager to see how voucher schools will stack up against their public school peers on these report cards.
And these report cards are due when?
Well, they come out in the fall. That's what we are told. And we've been waiting on them. Maybe the higher volume of schools included is a reason for that.
Well, hopefully we will hear from you when those numbers come out.
Yeah, I'm planning on watching for them.
Rachel, thanks.
Thanks.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. She joins us every couple of weeks for her segment that we call Passing Notes. You can listen back to past interviews, find more education news, and suggest stories for her to cover at WUWM.com.
Next on the show, the developer of a groundbreaking web series based on his life as a trans masculine male. A conversation with Emmett Lundberg is next on Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. LGBTQ representation in the media has been gaining significant ground in recent years on TV shows like Orange is the New Black, Transparent, Modern Family, and even the recent reboot of Will and Grace. However, while representation grows, it does not cover the full spectrum of the LGBTQ culture.
Emmett Lundberg is an author and filmmaker with Milwaukee roots, and he was longing to see his own story of being a transmasculine male represented. And so he developed the web series Brothers to represent that population and its own diverse experiences.
The series follows four transmasculine friends, Jack, played by Lundberg himself, Davin, Aiden, and Max, in their daily lives, the ups and downs, ins and outs, or what it means to live as a transgender individual in urban society today. The second season of the series is now under development. The first season will show as part of the LGBT Film Festival currently underway in Milwaukee.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Emmett in 2015 about the series, the filmmaking process, and the issues and challenges that transgender people face in America today, which the series brings to light.
I created this series originally because I really wanted to see more trans masculine content. There's not a lot out there. We're at a point where there's starting to be a lot more trans women represented in media, and it's still lacking for trans men. So I wanted to see that side of the spectrum represented, and I wanted to see my own experience reflected in a show that I could relate to.
And do you find that independent series and movies are the best way to tell LGBTQ stories more authentically? Because as you mentioned, we're getting a little more visibility. with trans women. There's Transparent, the Amazon series. Mm-hmm. There's been Trans America or trans characters in other films and movies. Yeah. But when it comes to TV series that really go in depth for characters, you know, with films, you have these characters for a set amount of time. But with series, you really delve into it a little more. So is that why you chose to do this? And also, why is it in a format where each episode is about less than 10 minutes? So what kind of story arc are you building with that format?
The format has a lot to do with not only being able to produce a certain amount, you know, because of funds, we're limited to kind of less than we'd like to. The ultimate goal is to have them be 30 minutes and, you know, be on a network, be on Netflix, on Amazon, something like that. But this is the content that we're able to produce. And I think based on this group of friends, it lent itself to being told as a series as opposed to a film. It made much more sense. There was much more room for the guys to grow, to kind of see all the story arcs, to even explore new ones. The second season is going to have a lot of new characters. And a series really allows us to do that.
How do you think your series is offering an alternative narrative and better representation of transmasculine males in a scripted series?
I think that Brothers, at least what I tried to do, was show kind of different levels of transition, people in different places, you know? Not everyone is at the same place in their transition. Not everyone wants to do the same things in their transition, and it doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. So what I really wanted to do was show that the trans masculine experience is different for each person, and that doesn't mean that they're any less trans than someone else.
So give us some examples of the different transitions compared to these four characters. Mm-hmm. Explain some of the trials trans people go through medically, personally. The series, it opens with a really good shot that I liked of just the daily life of Jack and taking hormones and all these things, you know, normalizing the daily process, the daily lives of these people. So what are the things you're trying to highlight through these different characters and their different stages of their lives?
Yeah, I really wanted to show, like you were saying, that normalization of being trans, because it's just one facet of who these characters are, and it's a facet of who I am. It's a facet of, you know, trans people. It's not our entire life. It's not our entire experience. And I think to show, you know, taking the hormones and having trouble with IDs and that type of thing is really showing people that we deal with these things on a daily basis, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the end of the world. Like, you know, we learn to deal with these things, and they're frustrating and they're annoying. And sometimes, you know, I come from an experience that is very privileged, and I know that and I acknowledge that. So, you know, I'm lucky that I haven't had to deal with perhaps some of the stuff that other trans people have had to face in terms of violence, discrimination, that type of thing. But I want to show from my own experience what it means to live as a trans person and what it's like just day to day.
So let's go into your background a little bit. You're from the Milwaukee area, and you just mentioned that you think you've come from a privileged background. So what's your experience of being a trans male?
Well, yeah, so I'm from Milwaukee. I grew up in Menominee Falls. I went to the Milwaukee High School of the Arts, and I went off to NYU. That was the only school I applied to. I knew I wanted to go to New York, so I went at the time while I was in high school, and actually when I was at NYU, I was still identifying as a lesbian. And then a few years after, I started to think about it probably towards the end of my college career, I started to realize what being trans meant, what the words even transgender meant, you know, because I didn't feel like I had any experience with that word growing up. I don't think it was like in my vocabulary and I didn't know what it was. So when I realized what it meant, I kind of got this fascination with it, and I looked up everything I possibly could, and it really made sense to me, even though it still took me a good, I would say, 5 or 6 years after that to come to terms with it and to say this is who I am and I want to take medical steps to feel more comfortable in my body. And, you know, being in New York, I was able to go to an LGBT clinic. So they recognized my gender identity. They always used the correct pronouns. I was able to have access to hormones basically as soon as I wanted them, which is kind of unheard of, you know, for people in other states. I also really had a lot of support from my friends and family. So not that my story is uncommon. I think people do have that story, but I think there is also the other side of it where, you know, it's people lose their family, they lose their friends, and they don't have access to what they need to have access to feel like who they are.
And with your experience growing up here and then traveling from here in New York in your current life, how do you see the differences in LGBTQ communities or even resources in Milwaukee compared to New York? And is that part of why you stay in New York now too?
I mean, I definitely think it's something that keeps me there, having that access to, because, you know, taking hormones is something I'm going to have to do for the rest of my life. So until I think the rest of the country kind of catches up, it's not going to be at the same level. I don't have a lot of experience with the community here, so I can't speak to it totally, but I'm sure there is a difference, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or even just in resources as well.
Yeah.
Have you noticed more positive changes as you've come back to Milwaukee and you're here for a couple events in the upcoming week as well?
So far, it seems like people have responded really well to just having these events here. I like to think that maybe that does mean, you know, there's progress being made and that people are opening their minds a little bit.
And with your series Brothers, did you have any difficulties finding trans actors? Because obviously the show is about being authentic and, of mm-hmm. course, having trans actors is a massive help.
Yes.
And it brings a whole other dynamic to these characters, you know, subtly or through the actors portraying these. So did you have people that you knew that was immediately like, yes, I want this as a passion project?
No. We cast everyone, so I didn't know anyone in the show prior to doing the show. And it was difficult to cast trans actors. We didn't have a lot of response when we first set out to do it because no one knew who we were. So, you know, we did a casting call. We saw a few people, and I said, these people I think can really grow into these roles and kind of work with us. And they were really, really wanted to be a part of the project. And like you're saying, it adds a level of authenticity that I think is not there. Not that a cisgender person could not play a trans actor, but I think that there's that life experience of living as a trans person and playing a trans character, which was really important to me and for the show as well. In terms of bringing on crew, I think it was pretty, you know, we were lucky. We had a lot of people, very talented people, who wanted to be a part of it. My producer, Sham, came on, and she's the one who really helped kind of bring it all together, figure out what we needed to do. We decided to do an Indiegogo campaign for the first season. We raised about a quarter of what we were asking for, and so we were able to make the show, but we weren't able to pay anyone. So season two, we want to do it the right way. We want to pay everyone. We really want to do it as, you know, a full production.
What made you want to go beyond creating this show and going in front of the camera?
I think originally it was logistics. The guy who shot it, the DP, is my roommate. And so that scene in the pilot where I'm in the bathroom and I'm giving myself a shot, it was really me doing my morning shot on a Friday morning. And it was at like 5 in the morning before both of us went to work. So it kind of made sense that we did that, that I was the main character. It was a lot less scheduling. And after doing it, I had a lot of fun. You know, I really enjoyed being in front of the camera. So I'm looking forward to doing that more this season and letting other people do more behind the camera.
So what are you keeping in mind as you move forward to keep this authentic? And what message do you ultimately want to send out to all audience members?
I mean, I think ultimately, I just want to make a great show, and I want to make something that people really want to watch. And the fact that it follows these trans guys is kind of secondary to me. I know that a lot of people see it in another way. They see it as this, you know, you were saying before, it's educational. It kind of sheds light on this experience that isn't really known in the public eye. But I would just love to be able to make a show that anyone would want to watch, you know, no matter what their experience. And if they learn something along the way, that'd be great.
Well, Well, I wish you the best of luck in continuing the series. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Milwaukee area native Emmett Lundberg speaking with Audrey Nowakowski in 2015. Lundberg is an author and filmmaker. The second season of his series, Brothers, is under development. The first series screens as part of the LGBT Film Festival tomorrow at 5. There's a link to more at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break now, and then author and innovator Nilufer Merchant shares her thoughts on how any one of us can make a dent in the world. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The world is awash in ways we can make a difference, but often we are our own worst enemies. We downplay our ideas as silly or impractical, or if we do present them to others, they get shot down and we never bring them up again. Nilufer Merchant wants to change that.
Merchant is an entrepreneur and innovative business thinker who's launched more than 100 products and successfully advised companies such as Apple. Her new book is called The Power of Onlyness. It's a series of stories and examples of how people turned not me into yes, let's go. And in the process, they made a difference in the world. Merchant was in Milwaukee in August, and she stopped by the studio then to explain what she means by onlyness.
I coined the term back in 2011, 2012, and it was a business concept that I was trying to name. I was trying to say value creation shifted from organizations and from capitalization to ideas. Where do ideas come from? They come from that spot only you stand. And so I was characterizing that, but like struggling with, well, how do you name it? And in a distributed world, it would mean that ideas born of different onlys could actually count. And yet I was trying to use words like talent, and talent didn't work. And then words like uniqueness. And I'll tell you why talent didn't work, because it might help. Talent is often, when people say someone's talented, they'll often say, oh, it's because someone has credentials, or someone has the right academic background, or the right brands that they've worked with. And I was trying to say, no, what is that thing that says each and every single one of us has some bit of value to add to the world? Based on that spot in the world, only they stand. And we kept kind of coming back to that notion of only, and hence this distributedness, right? Connectedness allows you to scale things. So that's the heritage of the word onlyness.
And it is individual, as you say, but you've also expanded it into the idea of it being collaborative, too, that there are many onlys that can come together to become greater than the sum of its parts.
Right. I wasn't saying only like more of you, because onlyness could be like that kind of word, right? Could be a hybrid word, which like cats, like the S added to cat is more of cats, you know, kind of thing, the plural. I was trying to say, what is it that you care about based on that spot in the world only you stand in, based on your history and experience, visions and hopes, that then connects you to the world? And so that's the braidedness of the two pieces. Those two belong together.
And you have a lot of examples in the book of how people had this spark of an idea, maybe not even a whole idea yet, but some niggling thing that says, this isn't right and I want to fix it, or I see something that could do something else, but then how they expand that. And how do you see this as different from, say, any other business manual that says, you know, everyone collaborates and works together and, you know, makes a product? How is this different?
Well, I think there's probably three pieces to that. One is, there's a lot of us whose only don't count. We get told, because we don't fit the cultural dominant narrative, we get told that our ideas are marginal and therefore meaningless. Just as an example of that, and I'll click back to those other two pieces. So an example of that was Kimberly Bryant, who wanted to shape the future of technology. She wanted people who look like her to really be an equal member of the tech community. When she was first introduced to her colleagues at first sort of major engineering job she had, her boss introduced her not by Kimberly Bryant here, the passion she has, or Kimberly Bryant and the unique skills she brings, but Kimberly Bryant, with her, we got a twofer. And what her boss was pointing out was that Kimberly is a Black woman in tech. And so he was basically characterizing her otherness, not her onlyness, right? That thing that would allow her to contribute that which only she could bring and actually allow her to build on our ideas. So for those of us whose only have been marginalized, the first step in this process is to claim your only even when someone else has deemed it not valuable.
Which can be so difficult to do.
Oh my gosh. It's the most, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to people, they make it like they look back at me like, gosh, that seems pretty normal. And I said, yeah, it's both the most ordinary idea in the world and the most revolutionary idea in the world at the same time, depending on who you are, right? And it just, the difference is that there's 30 to 40% of a population that fit the dominant cultural narrative that is told in America that is mostly white, heterosexual males. So for the rest of us, we get to leave our ideas mostly at the door because we're told messages, right, that we have to overcome in order for us to be able to claim our ideas. The statistic that really struck me, though, to show how big of a problem this is, though, so one of the pieces of research I found was that 61%, and this is a U.S. statistic, of the U.S. population conforms or fits in to the dominant narrative. So they basically, the word that the researcher used was, do you cover? So this was self-recognized covering. And the examples were like the guy who didn't want to talk about his kids at work because he was afraid his colleagues would think he didn't care and wasn't committed to his job. And so he found himself covering his own passions and interests about being a good dad and having an equal responsibility as a family man and sort of focused on other things. And there were tons of other examples. And the 61% number didn't shock me, but I'll tell you what did. A whopping 45% of single white men cover. And what that shows us is how significant this covering thing is. And the implication is when we're not showing up fully alive in the places we work, in our communities, even in our own lives, what it means is we're not showing up with our ideas. And that little bit, or maybe big bit, that we could add to the world because we're figuring out a way just to hide, right? And how to fit in. And fitting in is the greatest cost to our own ideas.
But yet, one of the things that was a sort of a theme through the examples that you wrote about in the book is that innovation, coming up with or allowing these new ideas to blossom, oftentimes it gets stifled because I think as a species, we tend to want to go to the familiar. We are creatures of habit. Even when it's not a good habit, we tend not to want to break away from it. So the innovation sort of withers on the vine. And so how does onlyness and embracing that help us get past that hurdle?
Well, it goes back to the three things I was going to say, and then I distracted myself by telling a story. But you've just helped me kind of clue back in. So the first piece is to claim, which we just kind of talked about with Kim, really choosing to claim that part of the story that was hers. And by the way, Kim's gone on to train 10,000 black girls to code by starting a program. And she named it Black Girls Code, partly to claim back that story that was hers and to say, no, even if other people in society say this is not important or marginal in some way, for her it was meaningful. The second piece is to figure out, how do you find the other people like you? And whatever that little sliver of interest is, now you can, but it means you have to know how to signal your own interests and to seek the other people out, and then how to even have a common framework, how to have those other people you can count on. So that piece of finding, you know, it's so overused and yet such a deep insight about how do you find your people, not just based on heritage or socioeconomic education or all those other things, but based on what you're passionate about.
And I think everyone would say, well, I don't know. You know, sometimes you just fall into them. You're lucky, you meet. But this sounds way more intentional than that. This is actively seeking those people.
It is. And I was fascinated by the story of Alex Hillman when I found it, because Alex was a young man in, where was he, Philadelphia, and was working at a web design firm during the day. And as he described it to me, sort of sitting over his computer hunched over it, eating Chinese takeout every night because he was so deeply lonely and he missed having a group of people who he called, you know, creative maker types. And everywhere he would go in Philadelphia, he would say, gosh, I can't seem to spot anyone like me. And they seem sort of older and more traditional, and even the tech community seems sort of dated. And so he was going to leave. And at one point, the job he was going to leave to in Silicon Valley ends up falling apart. And he kind of thinks, I love Philadelphia, though. I love the spirit of it. I might just try one more time to find my people. And this was really a fun little part of the vignette, he says. And I changed what I wore to the next event. And he changed from wearing suits to these events to wearing these ironic T-shirts that he loved and flannel sort of sweatshirts over it. And then he basically looked for someone who was as geeky as him. And his only goal at that one event was to find one person. Then he went out and asked that person out to beer. Then the next event, he tried to find the next person. And after a while, he started gathering those people together. So it was super intentional. And digitally, he was actually searching them out, like on LinkedIn, and figuring out, like, did they match the profile of, you know, what he was looking for, until he finally started gathering all these people together in coffee shops every Friday, these geeky developers. And finally, first of all, he didn't feel alone. But it turns out that this thing that he thought he was the only one, he ended up finding a whole tribe of them. And they ended up building a co-working space together that's called Indy Hall in Philadelphia. 300 people now co-work together in this space. And when I talked to the deputy mayor of Philadelphia and I said, you know, what did this mean for you? And he said, you know, we always wanted to be an entrepreneurial hub, but we could never find those people. And what Alex and then his crew of people did was basically self-organize. And now all of a sudden the city could figure out how to serve these entrepreneurs better. And so there's this weird thing about when you find your people, you think they're invisible, but it's you signaling what you care about. And that's why the shirt changing thing was so interesting, right? Like, because he's almost rolling up his sleeves and showing his tats in that process. And then signaling, like, here's who I am, world. Who are you back? And then intentionally finding the people who had similar passions and therefore could ultimately end up doing something with that.
You talk a lot about people discovering that they're asking the wrong question and being willing to say, whoa, I thought it was about this, but it's really about this. And being able to then take steps. And it sounds like if you have your tribe together, that if you discover you've asked the wrong question or series of questions, it's more easy to shift. Because institutions aren't known for being able to shift quickly.
That's true. And this has actually been the work I've been doing for the last 20-some years, right, is I've been figuring out how to do organizational transformation. And so what's funny now in looking at this set of stories, because now I'm focusing on the individual ideas out and less organization down, I'm sitting here going, okay, what is it that derives real change from the organic level out? And this thing that you're pointing out, which is about how you change the framework by which we hold something as true, is a way in which you can actually create change. Franklin Leonard was my favorite story out of the book. In that example, Franklin is a young man who ends up showing up in Hollywood basically as a grunt after working at McKinsey and a couple other places, and mostly just because he loved movies. And he's like, I'm going to join this industry, and I'll figure it out. And the first year is brutal because he can't find any scripts he likes, and yet that's one of his jobs, is to find scripts. So he sends out a note to everyone he's met, and he asks them three questions. And he says, tell me a script that you love that hasn't been put into production that you've seen in the last year. And he says, in return, I will cross-tabulate all this stuff, because he's a former McKinsey guy, cross-tabulate all this stuff and produce it back to you. That's my give. Do this by Friday and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up creating an alias so people don't even know it's him. And he gets all this stuff back, prints out the five scripts he's most interested in, goes on vacation. 2 weeks later, this was the days when we could actually escape our digital life. And he comes back and his email is full of people forwarding him this master list that he had created, saying, this is so cool. And he's telling me this story. And I said, well, you know, Franklin, what did you think you did different? Like, what do you think really caused it to succeed? And he said, oh, I did this and did that. And I don't really think that's it. And this is me kind of giving him feedback, right? And the more I looked at stories that were parallel to him, because I studied 300 stories in order to pick the final 20 that made it in the book, and I thought it was actually quite different. It was that he asked an original question. So he asked, and he asked it so fast even that I think you can skip past it. He asked, what movie do you love? What script do you love? And if you think about how Hollywood was actually sorting at the time, they were sorting by how did this make money?
I think they still do, probably. But...
Well, and so it turns out the Blacklist has deeply informed how Hollywood sorts scripts. So that's the organization that he's built. And in fact, I think it was something like 300 of the top films that were produced in terms of just revenue, something like 75% of them were first on the Blacklist. So these are films that were in the dustbin that are basically resurrected by people who say, no, 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 this is an idea worth paying attention to. But what was so fascinating was this tilt of frame. Going back to the original question of any industry, right? Healthcare, for example, is an industry that's premised on care, but doesn't always achieve that. Education, driven by learning, doesn't always achieve that. So how do you originally go back to the original question of what are we here to do? And how do you reframe that question together in such a way that you can start to create change? And I would say every person did that by having a new lens and by holding on to that lens both tightly enough and loosely enough that they were able to create the change.
Great to make a dent.
And to start.
Nilufer Merchant, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Author Nilufer Merchant is a leading business thinker and innovator. Her recent book is The Power of Onlyness, Make Your Own Wild Ideas Mighty Enough to Dent the World. She was in Milwaukee in August to speak at a 1-800-CEO-READ event and stopped by the studio then.
Keep listening. Bubbler Talk and a special sort of Bubbler Talk Extra are next on Lake Effect right here on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The Hone Bridge. It's a Milwaukee landmark and a daily route for many of the city's commuters. But perhaps you've noticed a certain smell that infiltrates your car as you're driving.
Oh, what is that?
Ew.
Oh, that's not good.
I'm Audrey Nowakowski, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, a listener named Terry asked, what's that rotten egg smell driving over the Hone Bridge? Well, to find out, I took a trip to Jones Island to meet Bill Graffin, Public Information Manager for the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District.
It's a tough call where exactly it's coming from, but when you're driving over the bridge, over the wastewater treatment plant, probably a good guess that it's coming from here.
Jones Island has been home to MMSD's wastewater treatment facility since 1926. In other words, it's where your sewage goes when you flush the toilet, run your garbage disposal, or spit toothpaste down the drain. However, it turns out that that crap you smell is actually doing a lot of good.
We treat wastewater here, and we also have a distinctive smell that comes from the production of malorganite, which is a fertilizer that we've been making since 1926 and selling around the country.
Malorganite stands for Milwaukee Organic Nitrogen. This organic fertilizer is made with that wastewater you smell. Here's how. First, the screening process takes out all large objects from the untreated water. Then, it's off to the settling tanks, where oil and grease float to the top and solids sink to the bottom. The third step is a secondary treatment that involves microscopic organisms, also known as the good bugs.
Those organisms, or bugs, eat organic material out of the water. They clean the water. They're the workhorses of wastewater treatment. And we take a certain percentage of those bugs out of the mix every day and reintroduce the rest back into the tanks to clean the water. And we take those bugs and we put them into this big, huge building, the malorganite factory, and we squeeze the water out of them. We put them in these huge dryers and tumble them to certain pellet sizes. And then they're sold as fertilizer around the country.
What water is left from the treatment process is disinfected with the chlorine byproduct that is then neutralized before it's returned to Lake Michigan.
The water that goes out of the plant is much, much cleaner than what comes in. And, you know, we have a pretty good track record meeting treatment standards that are above and beyond what the state and the federal government calls for.
So depending on the wind direction or even the season, Bill Graffin says the smells are just a part of living in the city.
Well, there's no question that it is a beneficial reuse, but if it's an odor to someone, it's an odor. You can't explain your way out of that one. Right. If people don't like it, I don't know what to say, except we're looking at it. We're trying to come up with some solutions here.
And if you are skeptical about using biosolids such as malorganite in your garden or on your lawn, Graffin says that its 91-year history and counting speaks for its quality.
People love malorganite. I mean, the golf course superintendents, the master gardeners, people who really know their stuff know it's a great product, and it's a slow-release fertilizer that just is fantastic. You know, we call it goof-proof because you really can't screw it up.
But if the smell truly does bother you, you can always plug your nose as you drive over the bridge. Just remember to keep the other hand on the steering wheel.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
It's listener suggestions that inspire the features that make up our weekly Bubbler Talk segment, but Bubbler Talk itself was the inspiration for a student project that played out earlier this year in the community of Slinger.
Slinger Middle School English Language Arts teacher Paul Walter runs an author's camp each summer in the district with nearly two dozen participants from grades 6 through 12. Their project this summer, create Bubbler Talk-style features about the lesser-known history of notable places in the Slinger area.
The pieces themselves came together in the weeks after the camp ended. We were joined in the studio not long ago by Paul Walter, along with a couple of students, including Walter's own daughter, 7th grader Abby Walter, and Slinger High School junior Rachel Mull. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Paul, give us some history on this project. This is not the first sort of unconventional reporting work that you've worked on with your Authors Camp students, right?
Yeah. So we've been doing Authors Camp for, I think, 6 years now. And every year at the end of camp, we like to have a writer's marathon where we go around and write in a variety of different locations, have some different prompts to write to. So we started out going to Pike Lake State Park. We ended up going to the Museum of Wisconsin Art. And we really liked those marathons, but it seemed like that was just we went for the sake of having some place to go, and it wasn't really a way to bring the camp together and culminate. So the last couple of years, we've been trying to do things around the community. I think it was 3 years ago that we got in contact with the people who do urban spelunking through onmilwaukee.com.
This would be Bobby Tanzillo.
Yep, Bobby Tanzillo. And so we did what we called suburban spelunking, where we went into some places around Slinger. We went to the Slinger House, which was an old tavern meeting place where a lot of farmers would gather together. We went to a garage where the gentleman worked on Model T cars a long time ago, and then and so we went around to some different places and recorded wrote those stories. The kids wrote those stories. And then last year we tried to do a Humans of New York type thing where we went actually down to Cedarburg and we called it Humans by the River. And we tried to interview people that were going up and down the river. Abby ran into her old kindergarten teacher buying some wine. That was kind of fun. And so we made kind of an online storehouse for all those pieces that we did. And this year we were, you know, thinking about something to do. And I'm a big listener of the program of 89.7 and NPR in general. But those Bubbler Talk segments just seemed like they would really be ripe for us to do some community reporting as well.
So before we even get into how you did that this year, what's the ultimate objective of this author's camp? And, you know, what do you hope that the students who come through it walk out with?
Sure. So our slogan is write what you love. And we have kids that are really into writing science fiction, some that are writing into writing memoir, poetry. And so at the one of our big goals is to get the kids published, to find places outside of the classroom walls where we can get publication. And we've done that through the Scholastic Art and Writing Contest. We've done it through Wisconsin Outdoor News Contest, through Milwaukee Public Museum Poetry Contest. And so we just wanted to show the kids that there's reason for writing outside of what we do in the classroom, which is great, but sometimes a little bit we have to adhere to standards and we have to adhere to curriculum. What we do at camp is beyond that. As a teacher, it's super refreshing because these kids come in, they want to write, you give them a prompt, they go write for an hour, and you almost have to come corral them back again because they just want to keep on writing. And as far as the community connections, I've been doing some work with Nate Grimm, who's a sociology teacher at the high school, and he's really helped me to make some community connections and realize just how important it is as writers to connect to the community that we have around us and the rich history of Slinger and the surrounding area.
Let me bring Abby and Rachel into the conversation because, you know, not every school student is into writing in their spare time. I mean, there are some students that go through school and hope that that is the last time they ever have to write anything in their lives. What is it that appeals to you? Why did you want to get involved in this?
Both of my parents teach like reading and English and all that kind of stuff. And I've just always really liked it. When I was little, I would just like grab my notebook and start writing poems. And so when he would have writer's camp and he would come home and I would just be like, oh my gosh, I want to be there. Why am I only in third grade?
So really, even if it weren't your dad that was running this, you would be all over the idea of writer's camp. What about you?
Well, when I was young, I was always a really avid reader. I would love to read. I would read on my own. My mom would read to me when I was really little. And I really just started getting an extensive vocabulary. And I never really had thought of writing until I got into sixth grade when my English teacher, I had written a piece for her, and she suggested, man, this is really good. You should look into this author's camp. And I'm like, huh. I've never really thought about trying writing before, but then I soon found that I really enjoyed doing it.
So you ended up tackling three subjects in this bubbler talk form. Let me ask you to talk, all of you in some way, about how you zeroed in on these three particular subjects.
Well, we wanted to make sure that to kind of keep with the bubbler talk idea, we didn't want to do anything real heavy. We wanted to think about something that really was a community interest piece, kind of a human interest story. And we know that we have these great places in Slinger that people know about, but maybe they don't really know about. They don't really know the history of the racetrack or the Jim's Place for ice cream or the ski hill that we went to. And so we thought that would be a great place to start and connect to some things that we always are around, but don't really get to see the behind the scenes all that often.
Well, so then let me ask our two radio producers here, how did you plan these stories out? What was the process like?
Well, we would listen to, like, the bubbler talk pieces, and then we kind of got into, like, these smaller groups of, like, us who really wanted to, like, go a little farther with it, maybe take it a little bit, spend a little bit more of our own time on it. And so we just kind of tried to figure out, you know, where does this transition go? How do we lead into this piece? And we were just having a lot of fun doing it, so.
And even asking you guys were the ones that came up with the interview questions.
Yeah. For the ski hill, the group I was in, there were like four of us. And so we just kind of went and talked to the guy and we found out some like really interesting stuff.
After hearing of all the different events held at Little Switz in the off season, we learned more about the hills themselves and if the myths surrounding the names were true. Turns out they were, and Jane Steele was named for one of the founders of the ski hill. Jane herself now resides in a house overlooking her very own hill.
Jane Steele is for one of the original owners, Jane Hurdy. And it's out of respect to her because she's still here. She lives in the house right here and looks out on the hill and was a key part of bringing it back and revitalizing Little Switzerland.
Anything you remember especially from either the ski hill or the other two stories?
What I remember from the Speedway, because we all ended up getting a tour, they ended up giving it a tour, it was really kind of interesting just learning about, like, the entire history of, like, what happened, how it started out, and I was learning about, like, events that I lived in Slinger and I never really knew about, so it was really just kind of a cool thing to be able to learn all that history.
Well, and then I know in one of the transitions you wanted to use the word pandemonium. Do you remember what event was that led you to the pandemonium?
That was for the Slam Fest's gauntlet race.
The guy, Jim Zirke, who you interviewed, he was obviously really passionate about the idea of crashing into school buses and trying to knock them over. So.
A popular part of Slam Fest is the gauntlet race. Jim spoke lightheartedly about the pandemonium associated with this event.
My favorite is the gauntlet race, and that's what I've raced in, where a small school bus, and then you have these guys whose job it is, by whatever means necessary, stop that school bus from making six laps. So you're pounding into it, and it's so much fun. Tip it over, spin it out, crash it. School kids.
Well, so let me ask you this, because I gather you were the person behind actually editing the audio together. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are professionals in the business, it can be a taxing job for us. What was it like for you? Because this is not something that you do every day.
Right. And I figured that it would be something that I could easily figure out. I'll download an app. I'll just splice the audio together. But what was nice is that we had all of the campers asking the questions. They wrote the questions. They selected which questions we should go with. They asked them. But that meant that I had audio from four or five different people from each piece. I had audio from our interview subject. And just the idea of actually breaking down those audio segments, since I had one long 10-minute recording from each place, it was definitely a lot of splicing and then removing little ums and ands and hiccups and things like that along the way. So it was a much more tedious process than I thought it was. But now I know how to do it, so I plan to record myself all the time and just
What was the hardest part of this for both of you?
For me, it was actually just doing the interview, and it was kind of like just a little bit nerve-wracking, like trying to, we had it all planned out, but then I'm like, you know, this person, you know, we need to get some good questions. They have a lot to say, and it was kind of hard to figure out how to get them to say everything that we kind of, that they needed to get out through our questions.
We decided to take an adventure and interview Mark Cool, who currently owns Jim's Place with his wife, and ask him about the diner we all know and love.
Well, our big seller is we very, very rarely advertise. We've been here for almost 43 years. Just a family atmosphere here, so, you know, we want kids come from...
Right, you have to be able to research it enough to know what they're going to talk about, but then the question is, how do you get them to tell those stories? Mm-hmm. How about you?
I guess really the hardest part for me was just getting the audio to work for me. But then writing the transitions, it wasn't too hard. It was just more of figuring out like word placement, how to make this sound very professional and very good.
So at the end of the process, what do you think when you listen to what's come together?
I just was really kind of excited about this whole idea. And I'm like, this sounds like what I hear on the radio, and I was just kind of really thrilled about that.
I think it just came together so well. Like, everyone worked really hard on it, and I think overall the piece, while I was a little hesitant at first, I'm like, how is this going to work? In the end, I think the product that we all made was very good, and I think it's just, yeah.
Are you all hoping to do radio pieces again sometime down the road?
I think it'd be really cool to do that, yeah.
Yeah, like, it was a really cool process, and it's like, now we know how to do it and everything, and if I can ever find another opportunity that I'm going to need to do it, I would just jump right on it.
Yeah. How cool. Well, thanks to all three of you. Congratulations, and I hope we'll talk again.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it.
Abby Walter is a seventh grader at Slinger Middle School, and Rachel Mull is a junior at Slinger High School. They were both part of the Slinger Authors Camp over the summer, which was co-organized by middle school English language arts teacher Paul Walter. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayan Silver, with production assistance from Meredith Waters.
We get additional reporting from Aisha Turner, Susan Bentz, and Rachel Morello, social media and web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.